Investors Chronicle.
Companies and Markets Podcast, welcome back. It's 1st of December as we record, listener. Cue the Mariah Carey, I guess. Christmas is here. Joining us, James Norrington. Hi, James.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Very good. Welcome back to the pods. Thanks. Alex Newman, hello.
Hello, John.
Mark Robinson.
Hello again, John.
Hello again. And Dan Jones as normal. Hi, Dan.
Hi, John. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What have we got coming up?
Today, we are going to start with our cover feature this week, which is on rethinking asset allocation and trying to ponder some of the developments that we've seen this year, developments, putting it politely, with the traditional 60-40 model. So James is here to talk about that. Then we are going to segue seamlessly into looking at the slightly better news for markets over the past few weeks. A lot of green, a lot of companies in the black, share price-wise, for the first time in a while. So we are going to interrogate the basis of that rally and whether there is anything particularly convincing behind it. And to conclude, we are going to look at a couple of food and ingredients companies, Treat, Cranswick, Devro, for which there has been a bid in the last few days as well.
Delicious. Sounds wonderful. Before then, a quick news roundup as usual. The former boss of recently collapsed crypto platform FTX, Sam Bankman-Fried, said he never tried to commit fraud, but that mistakes were made. A class action lawsuit was filed on behalf of FTX investors in the US on Wednesday, alleging FTX was a, quote, Ponzi scheme where FTX shuffled customer funds between their opaque affiliated companies. And sticking with crypto, a director general of the European Central Bank has warned that regulating cryptocurrencies risks legitimizing the sector. In a blog post, Ulrich Binseil wrote that Bitcoin is not a suitable payment system nor form of investment and should be treated as neither in regulatory terms. November saw UK house prices fall by their biggest monthly amount in 2 years. Figures from Nationwide saw a 1.4% drop from October as rising interest rates put buyers off. On the other hand, food price inflation hit 12.4% in the year to November, with meat, eggs, dairy and coffee some of the big climbers. Elsewhere, Shell has struck a deal to acquire Nature Energy for 1.9 billion euros. The Danish company is a producer of renewable natural gas from agricultural, industrial and household wastes. And earlier in the week, EasyJet recorded a record bounce back in demand after 2 years of COVID disruption. It has narrowed its pre-tax loss to just £208 million compared with losses in excess of £1 billion in 2020 and 2021. And finally, Federal Reserve Chair Jay Powell dropped a strong hint that the central bank will slow the pace of US interest rate rises. The S&P 500 rose 3.1% on Wednesday after the statement, bringing gains to 5.4% in November, and the Nasdaq added 4.4% to end the month. Lots more news and companies roundups in the magazine as normal and on the website. But for now, back to Dan for the rest of the show.
Thanks, John. So we will start today looking at asset allocation, looking at diversification, which James, who joins us, I see alpha guru James Norrington. As you open the cover feature this week, you say diversification long been touted as the only real free lunch for investors. But this year, that's proven easier said than done, I think. So can you talk a little bit about what your thinking was with this piece in terms of rethinking asset allocation and looking again at diversification and how investors can use it to their advantage?
Well, I think in sort of tough economic times, the only thing that really goes up is correlations. And obviously, you know, modern portfolio theory, sort of found about 70 years ago by Harry Markowitz, the whole premise is that the different correlation between asset classes is what protects investors in times of turmoil. That hasn't been seen in 2022, particularly sort of the right high inflation, periods of high inflation, we tend to see higher correlation between bonds and equities. And that's basically led to the fact that, you know, the bond prices and equity prices have both been going down. So you've seen capital losses on both sides of your portfolio. So if you're a traditional 60% equities, 40% bonds investor, you've really had nowhere to hide this year.
So with the piece, we are, you know, starting from that basis point, we're trying to think a little differently, think about how you can assuage some of these issues, how you can improve upon that portfolio. Obviously, there aren't necessarily that many individual investors who'll have precisely that allocation. There'll be lots of different things in any given portfolio. But what you've done is try to come up with some different models which may provide a little bit more ballast and a little bit more support in tough times, and also, in particular, on a risk-adjusted basis.
I think the first thing to be said is strategic asset allocation is still important for the long term. I mean, the very fact that we've had higher interest rates, interest rate increases over the last year, that does mean that going forward, probably even 60-40 is going to have offer you better protection. But it's really an opportunity to take a look at your long-term asset allocation strategy and think, can I do a bit better than 60-40? And in the meanwhile, well, you know, there are times when it's probably better to move to cash or to maybe to look at some other tactical asset classes such as gold or commodities in inflationary periods. So that's really what was looking at in the piece is looking at your utility as an investor. What's the best risk-adjusted, not just return, but risk-adjusted satisfaction you can get based on your personality type? So we looked at some models for doing that, and we also discussed some indicators which are probably quite good indicators within these different strategic asset allocation bands when there's times just to say, do you know what, I should be in cash for some of this asset allocation for this rough period. And actually, while it's hard to time that exactly, we all have emotional biases as investors, I think the window for making that decision to say of my, say, you know, 70% in equities, or I'm going to have half of that in cash for a short period of time. To think of those asset allocation slices as strategic, but there may be tactical times where you decide to take a bit of that off the shelf, off the table, and have it as sort of dry powder for the next lows.
As you say in the piece, you know, as is often mentioned, you know, the phrase is, it's all about time in the market, not timing the market. But as you just alluded to, there are potentially sell opportunities to think carefully about how your allocations could shift on a tactical basis when you're in a difficult period like this year. One of the rationales for this kind of thinking is something called GARCH, which we won't attempt to explain the acronym. You can read it because it's fairly unpronounceable as it is. But maybe can you say a little bit about what that shows in terms of what that indicates about volatility in times when things are looking quite volatile, what that potentially can tell the investor about what to do?
And it's a favorite of hedge funds, and really what the basic premise of it is that the smoothed out volatility. So people said about your risk, you've got an annualized volatility of X number of percent. Well, what GARCH recognizes is that the main contributors to those volatility is clustered. So the high risk periods are clustered. And what you can see by keeping track of GARCH, which is a predictive measure looking at previous volatility and how that's going to be sort of reflexive in the market going forward, it can be a pretty good indicator, and it can be elevated along with sort of some actually realized volatility to give you a relatively wide window of when you might decide to sell out of cash. You can see the difference in movements. The peaks, obviously, you can't really time, but it gives you a reasonable indicator to think when you also do a smell test, thinking about, what's going on in the economy, where are we in the credit cycle? You know, how many legs down have we had in a bear market? You know, you might think to yourself, well, hang on, you know, these indicators are suggesting that there's still a lot of uncertainty ahead in the economy and on the markets. So now might be a time for me to reduce some of my allocations into cash, for example, just to give you that bit of market timing protection.
Yeah, I think the basis of the piece, you know, a lot of these terms are quite complicated, even in acronym form. But the basis, I think, is we're trying to distill some of that complexity involved in you know, portfolio theory into something understandable for the average reader, and something that boils down to portfolios that when it comes to it, aren't necessarily very complicated, but they might nonetheless offer a little bit more to the average investor. So do, if you're listening to this and you are interested and this has piqued your interest, do pick up a copy and have a look. So we have more detail in there on those portfolios and in how they work and the rationale behind them. Speaking of, though, down markets and, you know, various legs down, things like that, and dead cat bounces, perhaps that probably brings us to our next section, where we are looking at the fortunes of markets over the last few weeks, where things have been going slightly better. We are coming to the end of the year. We're getting to the cliched Santa rally time now. We're in December. We've already had what has been a very strong November, just looking at a couple of stats. FTSE 100 has had its best month for 2 years. FTSE 250 has posted a 7% share price return. That's not the best month for 2 years, because we did have a similar rally in the summer, which, Alex, perhaps speaks to the fact that although times have been better over the last few weeks, that doesn't necessarily mean the pain is all over.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't really know what to make of it, to be honest. I think, yeah, whether it's the beginning of the end or the, you know, a dead cat bounce, as you said, or the end of the beginning, whatever it is. I mean, there's clearly a lot of cash on the sides waiting to jump in at the first sniff that things might be turning. So any comment from Jay Powell that, you know, interest rate rises might be, the pace might be slowing in the months ahead is seized upon as, you know, this is now risk on mode and it's time to pile back into equities. Similarly, you know, any reading such as, I think this week the Eurozone inflation print came in slightly below forecast, though at 10%, that's much higher than anyone would have been forecasting a year ago. So there is this, you know, there is a lot of anticipation and, like I said, cash on the side, keen to get in at the, you know, the earliest opportunity. I think until from the peak, which was last November, until the real trough, which was October, global equities fell 30%. That is quite a big drawdown, quite a big correction. So it is understandable that that investors are looking to jump back in, and you know, and looking to get greedy when others are fearful. But one thing I would just say, you know, there's obviously lots to talk about here, and also we can sort of talk about how sort of brief rallies are possibly not the thing to pay attention to when you're investing. But I'd say none of the massive risks really that have spooked markets over the last year have gone away. So we still have very high inflation, high interest rates, a looming recession, war in Europe, and, you know, fracturing geopolitical situation. So you've got depressed consumers, depressed industrial sentiment. You know, it doesn't mean that long-term risks aren't worth taking, but you know, to read into a rally, which has, you know, has been pretty strong over the last 6 weeks or so, that we've kind of, you know, we've sort of hit the bottom and now we can resume our sort of post-financial crisis bull rally. I think it's maybe a bit premature. Mark, I can hear your breath on the line. Are you eager to jump in?
My breath on the line. No, I just reiterate your point there. I mean, when you look at what's happened to index values in the US, for instance, that points to the rotation out of growth stocks into value. But the reason this has happened has as much to do with sensitivity to interest rates rather than any decisions that are based on fundamental analysis. And you've got a situation as well where, because of the interest rates, a lot of liquidity has been withdrawn from the market as well. I doubt very much whether there are any sort of crystalline assumptions baked into share prices and index values at the moment. But you know, it's far too. We're entering the leg where most of the economic pain will be evident, I tend to think, and that's quite a depressing thought in of itself. But certainly, even if inflationary pressures ease through next year, there are already definite signs that the labor market is suffering. And forward sort of various surveys recently demonstrate that firms are actually cutting down on their hiring plans into next year, and that will have a profound effect on the economy. I mean, we haven't had this situation in years, of course, where we've had to make assumptions on markets linked to high inflationary pressures. But in the past, we do know that when you've got job insecurity as a factor within the economy, that has a profound effect.
Yeah, I think, as Alex alluded to at the beginning, this is all premised on the fact that, you know, there have been some noises from central banks, which markets have taken a liking to, specifically the suggestion from the Fed that the pace of its hiking will slow slightly, albeit the peak ultimately might still be higher than people expect In the UK, obviously, the Bank of England is now, you know, backing away from market expectations of a peak base rate around 5%, something like that. So there is, to me, there is something a bit more to this than there was in July when that really seemed to be running on fumes. But yes, nonetheless, we're still in a situation where even if rates and inflation do peak, I think what central bankers, what most people are telling us, is that both will remain elevated for a long time to come.
Even though you've got this situation as well where the yield inversions have narrowed slightly over the last month or so, or certainly in the case of the UK since they had Rishi Sunak came into power. But it's incremental. It's still incremental at this stage.
Yeah, I suppose, I mean, markets, of course, are forward looking, and we've had episodes before, I suppose 2020 being an example where, well, two examples in some ways in 2020 where markets seize upon the opportunity to look much further ahead than the economy. First in April, where we had the really speedy rally from the bottoming out, you know, right in the middle of lockdown. And then in November, when the first sign of vaccine effectiveness really sparked a big rally as well. So it's conceivable that markets are simply anticipating, well, inflation is peaking. We are not through this. But as, again, as you said, Alex, you know, this may be the end of the beginning, if not the beginning of the end. And that can turbocharge things. But the difference being this time, money is not as cheap as it was, and it won't be as cheap as it was for a long while, you would expect. So investors are still going to have to consider the things they've been starting to look at in recent months in terms of, you know, debt financing of companies, things like that.
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, one thing to try and bring it back to some of the things James was talking about and the you know, the classic 60-40 portfolio. Mm. If I was going to sort of lay my cards on the table, and, you know, I'm not putting money to this or anything, but I mean, at the moment, it seems to me that the global equities still, I mean, I think we can accept the UK a little bit because it's a bit of a weird market and we've, you know, there's a bit more, that, you know, there's a higher allocation to commodities, which has been good this year. And, you know, there's the exposure to the pound, that's not huge. But I mean, global equities are, or particularly the, you know, which are dominated by the US, still look expensive in the sense that they're trading on around 17 times forward earnings. So if we're assuming that interest rates are going to be 3.5% at the end of the next year, and we're still going to have some residual inflation, even if it has peaks, that is a little bit expensive. But if you compare that to bonds at the moment and or fixed income, 10-year treasuries are yielding sort of over 3%. If your expectation is that inflation will have come down below that by the end of next year, which I don't think is a wild, wild call, if you are hopeful of that inflation peaking narrative, then there looks to be more of, it's not a guarantee, but there looks to be a greater chance of a real return in fixed income assets next year. So, you know, if you've been spooked by the last year, and almost everyone has, then and your risk aversion has you know, changed substantially by the market picture we now have, I think the you know, the safer bet, which traditionally is in bonds, is looking a little bit more, yeah, it's looking a little bit more reasonably priced now relative to equities. It's not my enormous 2023 call, but I'd say that's my cards on the line at the moment, looking at how things are.
That's your suspicion. So so as I say, you know, we are in December now. We've got a month to go of the year, and I mean, maybe some of it is that kind of Santa feeling as well. People like to have a good year end and then reassess in January.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a good chance we could see a little bit more of this in the next few weeks as well.
Well, actually, on the point of glad tidings as well, I think it's worth remembering that equity markets tend to retrace well in advance of the economy itself. So even if we're going through this, we have this pretty dire prospect in front of us for 2023. If we can go by history, then the markets will emerge prior to the economy itself, which is worth keeping in mind for investors.
Absolutely. Let's look at a specific company or two now for the first time this week. We are going to discuss Treat, the ingredients producer, and then maybe talk a little bit about pork with a couple of companies in the UK market, Cranswick and Devereux. Let's start with Treat, though. Mark, you covered the figures over the recent days. They come on the back of a bit of a warning on profits in August, but the, the business doesn't look in terrible shape nonetheless. Is that fair? A fair assessment?
Yeah, that is a fair assessment as well. I mean, the shares tanked on the August profit warning itself. There's the reasons behind that. The principal reasons behind it are beyond Treatt's control at the moment, and that's linked to the fall away in Chinese demand for obvious reasons, and also it's a question of the previous year comparator as well, because there was one specific contract that management alluded to, which makes this year's figures seem all the more anemic. The company itself produces natural extracts and ingredients, and it supplies into the sort of drinks business and also fragrances and some other applications too. And so we may remain sort of positive on the long-term prospects, because it's bought into the general trend towards healthier consumer ingredients. It's the reason why, for instance, that Tate and Lyle have been changing their product offering. And even a company like AG Barr, which produces Iron Brew, amongst other drinks, they've been trying to alter their product to in response to the secular trend towards, you know, healthier consumption. Comparative trading with Treatt within the higher margin tea category, that was the reason why margins have suffered this time around as well. But it's the management also makes the point that the company itself isn't that exposed to such volatility in margins normally. And there's also some problems as well linked to Forex hedging. In fact, they overhedge, so that can sort of eat into your margins too. But I would stress the fact that we still think it's a really interesting company. It's got a good track record, and a plus point as far as we're concerned at the IC, and from the point of view of our readers as well. They're very candid about where the business is placed at the moment. So looking forward, I would say, you know, this is still a really good company. And it's just that, like many others at the moment, there's going to be some sort of near-term turbulence.
Do you have a sense, or do the company provide much of a sense of you know, outlook-wise? Because as we say, you know, this has been a tough year, a couple of bad reactions to, I think, both the interim and the interim results and the trading update. But, you know, looking ahead, what are the, you know, long term, yes, still a good business, but in the medium term, what are the kind of potential catalysts there?
Well, the one thing they did point out, and I think it's they're justified in doing so, is that the drinks part of the business, or the ingredients they sell into the drinks business, will hold up better during any economic downturn, because that's just the way things are. People will still buy soft drinks. You know, if they're changing consumer habits, it will be in other parts of household expenditure too. But we did make the point, or I made the point anyway, that mightn't necessarily apply in terms of their fragrance products. You know, the rating is still reasonably high as well. It's 29 times forecast earnings, which I think it's that's obviously reflects August's markdown to a certain extent. But I think the balance sheet is solid enough. I don't think we're going to have, you know, a breakout in trading in the first half of next year. But I would say that it's a quality company, and in fact, you know, they were priced for growth as well even prior to August. But I think it's just an interim problem.
You mentioned China, and as a factor, which is the case for a lot of companies, including potentially another couple we're going to talk about now, Cranswick and Devro as well, in relation to pork prices. Both of these companies involved in that market. Let's start with Devro, because there has been a bid there for the company. Mark, again, you addressed this week in your column. Do you want to talk a little bit more about Devro and the opportunity there?
Well, it's odd when you read this, the takeover as well, because given the potential synergies between Devro and Saria, which is a German family-run business, there must have been sort of thoughts about a potential offer in the past. And so I, you know, come to the assumption that this reflects to a large degree just how cheap UK stocks are at the moment. It's been recommended by the board, and it's had a hefty premium to the closing price prior to the offer itself. And from all accounts, the main kicker in all this is Devereux's R&D and product innovation as well, which the German company can incorporate with their brand as well. They already have a commercial relationship, which helps matters along. So one imagines that this would close fairly quickly too. Yeah, when you think about it too, you know, the company, and in fact, Cranswick, have been affected in recent times by, well, for quite some period actually, because of the spread of African swine fever as well. And the fact, if you look back through their share price history, when they've shown weakness any time that we've seen an increase in pork prices, which is quite interesting in of itself. Pig prices had sort of gone through the roof earlier on this year, up until about midway through the year. But I was intrigued to learn that China, as you mentioned before, has a major lever in this market as well, because they seem to have what might be termed a strategic pork reserve there, which I think you looked at it a little closer than I did, Dan, which they've tried to release on a couple of occasions this year. But of course, you know, if more of that, more pork comes into the market, there's an obvious sort of downward pressure on prices. So that, you know, perhaps that's sort of positive for the business model going forward.
I had a brief look at the Chinese strategic pork reserve. You're right in that prices in China have really been soaring recently, and I think they've tried a few times this year to increase supply in a bid to stave that off and, you know, create some and prevent some difficulties emerging for the Chinese populace, but with limited joy so far because those prices are still climbing. But
I think there's every chance they will remain elevated, or at least they'll be okay, even if you have large increased volumes coming onto the market. We still have this problem linked to fertilizers and grain prices. And of course, that was in evidence at the beginning of this year, but you won't get the full impact of that until we go into next spring and summer. Then it will become sort of obvious, particularly with them. You look at things like the winter wheat production and the fact that, you know, that there are a couple of other areas of grain production which have been weak as well, including and soy too. So I mean, that's all going to sort of impact on livestock prices.
Yeah, Cranswick. Then Alex, I don't know if you have a view on the company. I mean, pork and poultry supplier. I think some analysts say that higher prices in Chinese pig prices, if we're going to return to that topic again, would be helpful for the company in the second half of the year in terms of, you know, it is able to pass those on relatively well, can help boost profits in terms of, well, revenues, certainly in terms of price, if not necessarily in terms of volume. What's your take on Cranswick as a business?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting business. I mean, they have managed to grow profits and sales quite well over recent years, but I suppose they're sort of, you know, as we kind of alluded to, there's a sort of twin track investment story here, that they are obviously they're dealing with, you know, international commodity markets and pork prices and the kind of magnetic pull of China as an export market, at the same time that they're catering and they're shifting their product mix to cater to a domestic UK consumer, and they have made efforts to broaden beyond, you know, dairy. So they've acquired a couple of they call them sort of Mediterranean ambient businesses, but I mean they've gone big in hummus and olives and kind of higher value, I suppose, kind of healthier vegetable or plant based foods. So they've kind of spread the risks a little bit. Between those two, you know, between those two stories, I think it's a little hard for them to communicate how they're going to grow margins, how they're going to, you know, grow as a business, because, you know, that they are buffeted by a very hard to call international story, as well as the, you know, as well as appealing sensibly and trying to market sensibly to the UK consumer. But I mean, one point I would say is what I think I do like about the business, and I say that I don't eat meat, so I'm a vegetarian, so, you know, that might sound surprising for me to say that, but I think the way they're kind of the business model, in that they own the assets, so not only do they farm but they process and they also supply, gives them it gives them a degree of control and long-term flexibility. I think it's kind of one of the things that attracted the private equity suitors to Morrisons last year, that there is, you know, an access both to the agricultural base of the company as well as, you know, a direct consumer relationship. I think you know, gives lots of options for a business in the long term, and probably justifies their rating, even though growth prospects a little bit shakier. So yeah, I mean, we've talked about Devro's takeover. I wouldn't be surprised if Cranswick is, you know, is an appetizing prospect for lots of international capital, albeit, you know, they're such an important part of the UK food system that it might attract you know, political scrutiny, I'd imagine.
I think it's worth mentioning as well that its poultry division was a standout performer at the time of the last full year results. But of course, there's a major outbreak of avian flu in the country at the moment, and the full impact of that hasn't been brought to bear yet. But that's a real potential problem. But Alex, I mean, when you look back at the numbers for Cranswick over the last few years, it's no wonder that they've attracted interest. You know, it's year on year increases in statutory profit and earnings, and sort of a decent dividend in the bargain.
Yeah, you do have to hand it to management. It's not easy managing these low margin businesses, but they've done a pretty good job, you'd say.
Aren't they based in Hull?
They're everywhere. I was just looking at the map of their operations. They're Hull based, but they've got a lot of farms in sort of East Anglia and sort of Preston and East Yorkshire, I think. So yeah, all over really.
Right grand.
Yes. Hull, I think they've got a few facilities there, haven't they? And cooked meats is another string to their bow, and they have a facility there as well. So I guess that speaks to one of your points, Alex, about the kind of a range of business arms, but also parts of the manufacturing process and things like that as well. Anyway, that does bring us to the end of today's podcast. Thank you to James, to Alex, to Mark, and to John. We will see you next week with another Companies and Markets show.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.